The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Derek Dreyer. I am the director of the Rosenbach of the Free Library of Philadelphia. You'll hear more about that in just a moment. But before I begin introducing tonight's speakers, I want to make the usual request that you silence your cell phones, avoid flash photography, and don't forget that after tonight's readings end, there's a book signing upstairs in the lobby. If you can't stay for the whole thing, or if you have friends who couldn't be here at all, many of the library's readings are also available as podcasts, so check those out too. So the Free Library has 61 different locations in Philadelphia. The Rosenbach is the newest of those, and I would suggest it's the most relevant to this evening's group of readings. After all, the Rosenbach produces Philadelphia's Bloomsday, a celebration of James Joyce's Ulysses, thank you, that is observed every June 16 with public readings from the novel. Tonight's event closes the 2014 Bloomsday Festival. I know at least a few of you were there on Monday. I suspect many more of you were as well. And I think you probably also all know that one of the authors who will speak tonight, Maya Lang, was specifically inspired by Joyce's great novel. Like Ulysses, her debut novel, The 16th of June, takes place over the course of one single day. It is a clever social satire that maps the family dynamic and its currents of longing, loss, and love as three Philadelphians, in this case, hurtle towards resolution by day's end. Less well known is the fact that the Rosenbach is also the go-to source for information about the development, publication, prohibition, and yes, liberation of Ulysses. Museum founder Dr. A.S.W. Rosenbach acquired the manuscript of Ulysses in 1924, and it has been a centerpiece of the Rosenbach collections ever since. At that time, it was illegal to buy or sell the printed version of the book in this country, which had just been published 2 years earlier. We preserve in our collections a copy of the fake binding, Dragnets, that was used to smuggle the book in sometimes. And to show you just what a good disguise it was, Kevin stopped by this afternoon and wanted to see it, and it took us quite some time to find it. In 1933, a band of literary and free speech activists helped initiate the landmark court case that set a precedent for First Amendment rights and cultural freedom. The Rosenbach also has copies of those court proceedings. It's a story so bizarre and interesting, it can't possibly have been made up. In the most dangerous book, Kevin Birmingham tells the great story about Ulysses from the first stirrings of Joyce's inspiration to a world forced to contend with a masterpiece. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Kevin Birmingham to the Free Library.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. So my book, The Most Dangerous Book, is the story of the fight to publish Ulysses, but also the story of the struggle to write Ulysses. And there was really an intense drama involved in the writing of a book. And I think there's really always a drama to writing something. And I'm trying to bring out what was specifically dramatic with Joyce and his writing. Of course, you know, when writing with pen and paper, it's not automatically a dramatic thing, so it's not easy to bring out what's dramatic in writing. Especially if you're writing with a laptop, that's got to be the least dramatic instrument available. But for Joyce, his writing process itself was highly unusual. And in addition to what was happening with his writing, he had to contend with many other difficulties. He began Ulysses during World War I, and he was living in Trieste, which was effectively on a battlefront between two warring nations. He had to flee Trieste for Zurich, and he had two children to take care of and to feed, and he was out of a job. And he decided that Ulysses was going to be a massive book instead of a short story to tag along in Dubliners. So, in addition to having to deal with the war, Joyce was undergoing increasingly bad eye problems, and these eye problems were recurrent throughout his life. And effectively what it was is he was suffering from what these days we now call acute anterior uveitis. At the time it was called iritis. Basically his irises were being inflamed. And so he would be walking down the street or he would be talking to someone and suddenly he would have a sharp pain in the inside of his eye because the pressure was building up. If the pressure gets too high, the only way to reduce the pressure is to undergo surgery, which involves effectively cutting away a small piece of the iris. Joyce underwent about 12 of these surgeries in his lifetime, and the fear of another attack of iritis was always with him, and the possibility that he would have to undergo an eye surgery, which was terrifying. And in addition to that, we have the series of medications that Joyce had to undergo, including scopolamine and atropine, both of which cause hallucinations. They're derived from belladonna. So I want to give a little scene of Joyce writing and sort of writing style, or really the writing process. This is 1917, and it's shortly after his first eye surgery in Zurich with Dr. Sidler. Somehow, despite war, pain, and atropine hallucinations, and his inability to earn an income, Joyce found ways to write Ulysses. There were small moments of health stolen in early afternoons, days of reduced pain and functioning pupils, a week or two of optimism inspired by Dr. Sidler's confidence. Joyce scrawled phrases on slips of paper that he left like Easter eggs in unlikely spots around the apartment. He would try to find them when he was better and piece together the lives of Stephen Dedalus and Leopold Bloom from scraps. It continued like this for years. There were few, if any, bursts of inspiration that set him composing paragraphs at a time. Ulysses was a procession of drafts, a sedimentary novel that gained its mass one grain at a time. Joyce kept notebooks and large sheets of paper crammed with character descriptions, lists of rhetorical devices, notes on mathematics, facts about ancient Greece, and Homer's The Odyssey. Sometimes the notes were arranged by chapter or subject, headings like names and places, theosophy, blind, recipes. He wrote down phrases and single words seemingly at random. Tainted curds, heaven tree, night of the razor, boiled shirt, Toro, and collected them in notebooks where they waited to be inserted into his manuscript like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. Big or small, one of his entries was simply we. Joyce seems to have known exactly where the fragments would go. Bloom must use the royal we, the embodied collective, at a certain moment in the Circe episode. Each time he inserted a detail into a draft, he crossed it out with a crayon until he had notebooks filled with large X's and lists of insertions struck through with red, blue, and green slashes. As time went on, Joyce's note-taking increased. There was a torrent of notes. He made notes from his notes. All of them together, he said, would fill a small suitcase. He stopped drafting on both sides of his notebook pages so that he could use the left pages, the versos, entirely for additions. Joyce built Ulysses phrase by phrase. Though he was far from Dublin, Joyce found his material everywhere. He mined the Club des Etrangers, his friends in Zurich, for information and manipulated conversations so that they would bear upon the subjects discussed in his novel. Everything around him, anything people talked about, had a potential place in his scheme, a Swiss pun, an idle gesture, the name of a poison, an item of physiology or folklore. Joyce was voracious. In the middle of a conversation, or at dinner, or while walking down the street, he would stop and produce a small notebook from his vest pocket and bend forward until his face approached the end of his twitching pencil and while he jotted down a fortuitous word or phrase. In August, after Nora took the children to Locarno to give Joyce the space he seemed to need, he wrote alone and talked to the cat. "Meow," said the cat. He wrote it down. So there's a little piece of James Joyce writing. And while the story is largely about Joyce, it actually, I think of it as a snapshot of a much larger constellation of people surrounding Ulysses and that were really important to the creation of modernism. There are many people that sort of come into the life of Ulysses. I think of this as the biography of a book instead of the biography of a person. And one of the most important people for this book was Sylvia Beach. Sylvia Beach, you will probably know her as the proprietor of Shakespeare and Company. Shakespeare and Company, she opened Shakespeare and Company in 1919 on the Left Bank in Paris. And she was inspired to open her bookshop because of the aftermath of World War I. She was volunteering for the Red Cross, and she went to Belgrade, and she spent some time in Belgrade, and she witnessed the devastation of Belgrade that was appalling. There were no bridges, the hospitals were destroyed, there were massive potholes in the roads. She remembers seeing the carcasses of horses still strewn about months after they had died. And she lived with the sort of desolation of Belgrade and the frustrating bureaucracy of the Red Cross. She said, "The Red Cross has made a regular feminist out of me because it's the women who do all the work and the men who take all the credit for it." And which would not be a surprise even today. And you could see her, both her frustration with these large organizations and the emerging desire in the letters that she's writing home to her mother, largely, but to both parents, her desire to do something important with her life. And when she was in the Red Cross, she found herself, you know, her first job was to hand out, as she says, pajamas and condensed milk. And she's handing out pajamas and condensed milk, but the people that she's handing them to don't have shoes. And she wonders why they don't have shoes or clothes and what weird loophole in the bureaucratic system had given them a bunch of pajamas when what they needed was their feet were becoming frostbitten. It was horrible. So she opens Shakespeare and Company, and she doesn't have much money. She actually sleeps in the back room of Shakespeare and Company. And she has a small cot set up with a kitchenette. And she's right next to a grate with a window, and she can hear the rats crawling along the grate. That's how she started. She was struggling to make ends meet. In 1920, she met James Joyce at a lunch party. And she remembers Joyce as being a bit shy and self-conscious, and he sort of retired into the library. And Sylvia Beach went to follow him into the library and asks, "Is this the great James Joyce?" And he looked at her and he said, "James Joyce," and shook her hand. And they began a conversation, and they were fast friends. The next day he was walking into Shakespeare and Company, and soon he found that he had a friend in the Left Bank. So the scene that I want to read here with Sylvia Beach takes place right after the 1921 trial, the obscenity trial against Ulysses, where a portion of Ulysses, the Nausicaa episode, was deemed obscene by a court in New York. So Ulysses was actually banned, or was deemed obscene before it was even finished. And when you ban a portion of a book, that suddenly makes the entire book potentially illegal. So so here we have, right after, following the trial, all of the publishers who were interested in publishing Ulysses fled. They decided, "We don't want anything to do with this unless you're willing to cut this obscene material." Liverwright didn't want to do it. Hoopsch didn't want to do it. And so here we have Joyce and Sylvia Beach. Sylvia Beach's offer happened casually, as if she and Joyce had been preparing themselves since they shook hands in Andre Spears' library, and now all they needed to do to launch the ship was break the bottle. Joyce, disconsolate, went to Shakespeare and Company and told Miss Beach about the Nausicaa conviction in New York. "My book will never come out now," he said. Her question, when she asked it, was an answer to Joyce's unspoken proposal. "Would you like me to publish Ulysses?" "I would." Sylvia Beach had never published so much as a pamphlet. She had no experience marketing or publicizing a new book, no background with distributors or printers, no familiarity with plates or proofs or galleys. She had no capital, and she could only guess about costs and financing. Advertising would have to be based on circulars, charitable press, and word of mouth. She knew almost nothing about the legal complications of the publishing industry in France or anywhere else, to say nothing of the complications facing a book convicted of obscenity before it was even a book. She knew the Circe episode was more offensive than anything in the Little Review, and she knew it would get worse. Despite all of this, she decided that Shakespeare and Company, a company of one, after all, of a 34-year-old American expatriate who was, until recently, sleeping on a cot in the back room of a diminutive bookshop on a street nobody could find, would issue the single most difficult book anyone had published in decades. It would be monstrously large, prohibitively expensive, and impossible to proofread. It was a book without a home, an Irish novel written in Trieste, Zurich, and Paris, to be published in France in riddling English by a bookseller from New Jersey. Joyce's readership was scattered. The book was at turns obscure and outrageous. Its beauty and pleasures were so coy, its tenderness so hidden by erudition, that when it did not estrange its readers, it provoked them. Ulysses was not even finished, and already it had been declared obscene in New York and burned in anger in Paris. None of this mattered. Sylvia Beach wanted to be closer to Joyce and to the center of contemporary literature. She wanted to be successful and to repay the money her mother had given her. She wanted to give the world something more than pajamas and condensed milk. So another one of the characters whose fate gets intertwined with Ulysses is Judge John Monroe Woolsey. And Woolsey is someone who has, for a while, been flying underneath the radar of history. Not too much has been known about him. And it just so happens that I tracked down Judge Woolsey's grandson and was able to... he is sitting on a trove of private materials that he shared with me, family documents and papers, unpublished articles, home movies... It's really tremendous, and he has a law library. The library in which he read Ulysses is still standing in Petersham, Massachusetts, and it's standing exactly the way it was in 1933 when he read the book. John Woolsey III showed me the photographs of them, and it was really remarkable to see this library. But the ACLU lawyer who wanted to legalize Ulysses wanted a judge to decide the case. Because as far as he was concerned, juries in obscenity cases were usually more stringent than judges, because in his opinion, you get 12 people sitting down in a room and suddenly they pretend to be a lot more pure and scandalized by things than they actually are. So he wanted a judge, but he also wanted a particular judge. He wanted a judge who was a reader, someone who cared about literature, someone who would be favorable to him. And he happened to know Woolsey was all of these things. And the reason why he knew it is because Woolsey had recently handed down two obscenity decisions that were favorable to the books that were being defended. And the reason why he knew this is because Morris Ernst was the lawyer defending it. So they already had a professional relationship. It was difficult. You can't simply order a judge the way you order a hamburger. So... he had to manipulate the calendar, and he stalled for months in order to get Woolsey assigned to the case. And that only happened partly because someone got sick, and Woolsey ended up taking his place. But Woolsey was actually happy to do it. And here is the introduction of Judge John Munro Woolsey. Judge Woolsey liked to lumber up to his library on the hill behind his summer home while huffing a cigar or a pipe. In 1933, he stayed long enough in Petersham, Massachusetts, to see the leaves beginning to turn at the end of a particularly lively season. Woolsey played tennis with his wife for recreation. He wore a tie to their matches. And lawyers scattered over the fields picking blueberries during lunch recesses. The judge's hilltop library doubled as a courtroom. There was a bench at the far end of the spacious hall and tables for counsel. In the hot months, Woolsey liked to get out of Manhattan and convene his federal cases in Petersham. This was actually legal at the time, where he could hear the summer birds during arguments and where his gavel, carved from the original hull of the USS Constitution, could remain mostly ornamental. The library used to be the town hall of Prescott. The Woolseys transported the entire building to Petersham, set it down at the top of the hill behind their house, and refurbished it with colonial paneling. When the judge was not hearing cases or writing decisions, he read in one of the upholstered armchairs by the fireplace. The wide floorboards creaked under his heavy legs, and he plumped himself down. Judge Woolsey probably wanted a drink. It had been over a decade since he had one because he considered it hypocritical to put men behind bars for selling liquor if he was going to drink it. A century-old bottle of sherry had tempted him in his Manhattan apartment since Prohibition began. But even a convicted bootlegger might not have begrudged the man a glass after the year he had endured. Woolsey had presided over a fraud trial of a corporation that had scammed hundreds of Catholic priests out of $3 million, purportedly to finance morally uplifting Hollywood talkies. It turned into the longest criminal trial in U.S. history. The testimony of 98 witnesses produced a 15,000-page transcript. The trial began before Christmas 1932 and didn't end until after the 4th of July. And when it was over, Judge Woolsey told the jurors they should form an alumni association. His trip to Petersham in the fall of 1933 was supposed to be his vacation. And he planned to spend a few leisurely weeks preparing to hear arguments regarding Ulysses. By then, Woolsey was comfortable with obscenity cases, so it would be rather enjoyable to apply the law to a book that was presumed to be a modern classic. Sitting in his library with his legs crossed and an open novel resting on his outmoded knickerbockers, he actually wore knickerbockers, several pleasures in life would coalesce. But that was before he knew what he was getting into. Reading Ulysses, he said later, was just about the hardest 2 months of my life. After several weeks, he had barely gotten through the first few chapters, and he postponed the case for another month. Woolsey was a promiscuous connoisseur. He collected colonial furniture and pewter, old clocks and maps, pipes and blended tobaccos. Filling his life with the trappings of culture was a way of living up to his name, like stuffing your grandfather's shoes in order to walk in them. John Munro Woolsey's first New World ancestor had arrived in New Amsterdam in 1623 and ran an alehouse on the East River. Woolsey's had attended Yale since 1705, and the judge was no exception. He was the descendant of a Yale founder, Yale president, and Jonathan Edwards, the preacher who reminded sinners of their depravity. Woolsey had received a growing pile of letters ever since the newspapers reported that he was presiding over the case. One man said Ulysses seared his soul. Another called Joyce's book the most precious thing in my life. Legally, the judge could ignore it all. The letters, the books about Ulysses, and the opinions pasted into the seized copies' covers, he could ignore them all. In fact, he wasn't even obliged to read Ulysses itself beyond the passages that the DA had marked as obscene. Judges were free to limit their evaluations to a book's objectionable portions instead of bothering with the whole text. Judging excerpts wasn't laziness. It was the logical consequence of the legal definition of obscenity. The Hicklin Rule was formulated to protect the people most susceptible to a text's corrupting influence. And as even the liberal learned hand pointed out, quote, it would be just those who would be most likely to concern themselves with those parts alone, forgetting their setting and their relevancy to the book as a whole. Judges and juries read books the way children did. Yet judges and juries didn't need the Hicklin rule to have their readings blinkered by an obscenity charge. The very nature of obscenity encourages a piecemeal approach to books. Obscenity offends. It reads as a singular, jarring moment, something ripped out of the larger context of the book, blinding us to mitigating contexts, is what offenses do. The word cunt or fuck stands out in relief against the page. Offended readers don't contemplate their function in the narrative's grand scheme or the role they play in the development of characters. They become fixated on the words themselves. Judges of obscenity are the closest of close readers. So there's the introduction of Judge Woolsey, and I hope it's it should not be a spoiler that it was legalized. So you can purchase Ulysses today. It did go beyond Woolsey's court. It was appealed by the government to the U.S. Circuit Court. But it was really Woolsey's decision that was crucial, and that had started to shift obscenity law. A lot of us remember Woolsey's decision today as a decision that changes the way we define obscenity, but the real truth, I think, is that it changes the way we define art. So far as Woolsey was concerned, in the hands of a great artist, a filthy scene or dirty word could be transformed into something powerful, something worthwhile, and something that should be read. It could be a little piece in a mosaic, as Woolsey called it. And that seems normal to us. But at the time, that was not the typical standard for the law. If there was a dirty word, it was a dirty word. It didn't matter how it appeared. It didn't matter who said it. It didn't matter what the purpose was. It was as if dirty parts of books were sort of alone on an island, and they were immutable. But Woolsey had sort of changed all of that. So do I have a little bit more time, or is it... Yeah? Okay. So I'll do a little bit more. This is very quick. But one of the things I wanted my book to do is to bring back Ulysses from the classrooms, to pull it away from graduate student seminars. We think of Ulysses as this book that is beloved by the person at the cocktail party you really don't want to talk to. The person who thinks of books as vegetables, something that you consume because it's good for you, something that you sort of wrestle over and it's not fun at all. But that's not at all the way Ulysses appeared at the time. When the initial reviews of Ulysses, Joyce was called an anarchist. He was referred to as a literary Bolshevist, whatever that means. I don't know what that means. He was, many people thought that he belonged in a criminal insane asylum. That's the terminology of the time, of course. And I wanted to recapture a little bit about what made the book dangerous to people, that they really thought, even beyond the sexuality, it was a problem. The sexuality itself was a problem because, especially female sexuality, was a force that seemed to be able to break families apart. And the most indecent people in Ulysses happened to be women, and that was scandalous. Gertie McDowell and Molly Bloom, they're the ones who are being indecent, and it was a horrible model for young women, something you could not have them reading. But even the experimental aspects of Ulysses were problematic. So what made Ulysses revolutionary was that it was a bid, it was more than a bid for marginally wider freedom. It demanded complete freedom. It swept away all silences. An angry soldier's threats in Night Town, I'll wring the bastard fucker's bleeding, blasted fucking windpipe. Molly's imaginary demands, lick my shit. And Bloom's appalling image of the Dead Sea, the gray sunken cunt of the world, are declarations that henceforth there would be no more unspeakable thoughts, no restriction on the expression of ideas. This is why printing the word fuck was more than schoolboy mischief. He says everything, everything, Arnold Bennett marveled. The code is smashed to bits. Dirty words were only part of the code-smashing liberation. The code Ulysses smashed was conceptual. For beyond liberation from silence, Ulysses offered liberation from what we might call the tyranny of style, from the manners, conventions, and forms that govern texts almost without our realizing it. The novel, as an art form, had long been about breaking the tyranny of style, but Ulysses removed narrative elements no one had considered removable. A single narrator guiding the reader through the story was gone. The contextual armature that helps a reader make sense of events was gone. Clear distinctions between thoughts and the exterior world were gone. Quotation marks were gone. Sentences were gone. In the place of style, we are left with borrowed voices and provisional modes, all of which are fleeting, all of which, as T.S. Eliot told Virginia Woolf, reduce style to futility. But why should it matter? The end of style seems a long way from Fenian bombs and the collapse of civilization. Yet the critics' comparisons were trying to capture the novel's apparent recklessness. To turn style into futility, it seemed, was to lay waste to all foundations. When a well-known poet named Alfred Noyes delivered a lecture in front of the Royal Society of Literature in October 1922, he launched into a familiar diatribe about the unprecedented obscenity of Ulysses. But what infuriated him most was that Joyce's emergence signaled the degradation of the United Kingdom's foundational values. Literary critics were casting aside the best of English literary tradition for madmen calling themselves modernists. It was as if an entire civilization were in the process of forgetting itself. To be oblivious of English values didn't strike Noyes as a matter of losing the past. It struck him as a matter of losing grasp of reality. Quote, "The lack of any conviction that there are realities, standards, and enduring foundations in literature has had a deadly effect," he told the Royal Society. Groundless literary criticism was introducing elements of chaos into the minds of the younger generation. He had a point. Narratives are the way we make sense of the world. We parcel existence into events and string them into cause and effect sequences. The chemist comparing controls and variables, and the child scalded by a hot stove are both understanding the world through narrative. Novels are important because they turn that basic conceptual framework into an art form. A beautiful narrative arc reassures us that the baffling events around us are meaningful. And this is why Ulysses appeared to be an instrument of chaos, an anarchist bomb. To disrupt the narrative method was to disrupt the order of things. Joyce, it seemed, wasn't devoted to reality. He appeared to be sweeping it away. If you were a modernist, if you believed the order of things was already gone, you thought differently. T.S. Eliot defended Ulysses by objecting to its critics' premise. Life in the age of world war was no longer amenable to the narrative method, and yet Ulysses showed us that narratives weren't the only way to create order. Existence could be layered. Instead of a sequence, the world was an epiphany. Instead of a tradition, civilization was a day. The chaos of modernity demanded a new conceptual method to make sense of the contemporary world, to make life possible for art. And that is what Ulysses gave us. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin, for a beautiful talk, and thank you all for being here. Also, thank you to the Free Library for having both of us. I just want to say on a personal note, I am elated to be here. I attended college at Swarthmore, which is a few miles outside of Philly, and would often come into the city with my friends. And after graduating, I lived in Philly for a year, and never in that time did I imagine that all of these places that I was visiting, beloved Philly places like Metropolitan Bakery or Primo's Hoagies or Audrey Clare, that these would one day make it into a novel. And to be here at the Free Library and to know that this is now a novel that's available out in the world is goosebump-inducing and quite miraculous to me. So thank you for being here to celebrate that with me. So typically what fiction writers do at author events is read, but I am not going to read. Part of that is because having attended many author events, I've realized that my favorite parts of readings are when the author talks about the stories behind the book, as we just heard, the stories behind Ulysses. So that is always the most fascinating part to me. I also find that fiction writers tend to do what I call the BAV, which is the breathy author voice. So I wanted to avoid that. So I thought I would give a talk about The 16th of June, my novel. And I will begin by telling you that in the weeks leading up to this book's publication, I've been hearing a lot of confessions from people, sometimes from friends. When I go into Simon & Schuster, I live in New York, when I visit my publisher in the city, I get confessions there as well. It's gotten to the point where I joke with my husband that I feel like a priest because I'm getting these confessions left and right. So what are these confessions? What it is that people come up to me and say, oh, I hear that you have a novel out right now that is about Ulysses, and it's sort of about Joyce, and I have to confess, I really tried hard to read him, and I couldn't make it through. And they also, you know, they want to know, do I need to have read Ulysses to read your novel? So first, I assure people that no, I would never expect that of anyone. But I also try and absolve people, as I think a priest would do, of this Joyce-related guilt. Because there is always this facial expression of apprehension and guilt and feeling bad about oneself for not having made it through this classic that we are all supposed to have read. What I hope is that I have written a novel that works on three levels. So I wanted The 16th of June to work for people who have never heard of Ulysses and who know nothing about Joyce. That was important to me. I also wanted it to work for Joyce buffs. And I have a PhD in comparative literature, so I know Joyce scholars. I wanted the novel to work for them and to speak to them. And then I also wanted it to work on a third sort of meta level, which was a reflection on the lore surrounding Ulysses. You know, Ulysses is not only revered by many as the greatest novel of all time, it is also the only novel I know of that has its own holiday, which we all just celebrated in Philadelphia on Monday, which is also the title of my book, The 16th of June. And, you know, part of what occurred to me as I was reading the novel for the first time is why Ulysses? We don't flicker green lights for Gatsby, or we don't, you know, turn the lights on and off in August for Faulkner. So why Joyce and why Ulysses? So I will tell you my own experience with Joyce first, which was that after many years of faking having read it through college, when I had skimmed it and perhaps, you know, looked at a couple of key passages that I could talk knowingly about it, I was in grad school and it was finally time for me to read it in earnest for comp exams. My time period was modernism, so I had to read Ulysses and had to read it for real. And I felt perhaps like Wolsey felt approaching it, which is to say daunted. And I also really wanted to love it because I knew about all of this lore surrounding it. So my way of approaching Ulysses was that I read the Odyssey in Greek first as preparation. So I did not go into it lightly, went into it very earnestly in a very dedicated way. And you know, I had every guidebook and I had the Ellman biography and, you know, everything. To prepare. And what happened was I started reading it, and essentially I couldn't stand it. Not because it was so difficult, I was prepared for that part, but what was off-putting to me was its tone. Jonathan Franzen has famously talked about Ulysses feeling like a chilly cathedral, the sort that you go to in Italy when you're doing all of your tourist things, and you go to that one cathedral that you're supposed to revere, and you end up just feeling its chill. And you know, Joyce at the time famously said he had set out to keep the professors guessing for centuries when he wrote Ulysses. You feel that right away. You feel his desire to confound. You feel all the references you're not getting, even if you have read the Odyssey in Greek. You feel all the stuff that you're on the outside of. And that, to me, was very off-putting as a reader, as someone who had prided herself on always loving novels. I had never encountered that before. Of course, I'd read difficult works and abstract works, but I'd always found my way in, and I'd always felt like I had the access code to get in, and I'd never felt rebuked before. I think that this is one of the things that the 16th of June is really about. There's a lot of Ulysses actually in the book, and if, as Kevin said, that some people view literature as veggies, I like to joke that I'm the mom who snuck the veggies into the brownies, because I have a lot of Joyce hidden in the 16th of June. Every one of my chapters is modeled after an episode in Ulysses, and I've excerpted lines that are in there. They're not footnoted, they're not quoted, they're not italicized, they're just woven in, so you get a little Ulysses without realizing it. But I also think in the novel that Ulysses serves as a kind of metaphor for all of those things that we should feel with a capital S. I think Ulysses is a symbol for all of those emotions, all those things that we expect of ourselves, the way that we want ourselves to feel, versus the reality of how we actually feel. And for me, you know, the discrepancy between what you're supposed to feel and what you actually feel applies not just to Ulysses, but also to one's 20s. I think when you're in your 20s, that's when you feel that discrepancy the most. And that's what all three of my characters are struggling with. So my novel consists of a triangle of characters. First, we have Nora, who, and all three of them are in their late 20s. Nora, the novel opens with her mother having passed away a year ago from ovarian cancer. And Nora feels that at this point in her life, she is supposed to be over her grief. Daily normal life is supposed to have resumed. And instead, she feels her grief worsening. Nora is engaged to Leo, who Leo was a frat boy in college. He loves watching SportsCenter. He loves drinking beer. He's an avid Eagles fan. He loves bathing his beloved SUV. He is your sort of Joe Average, very likable, very mainstream guy. And his goal, his aspiration is to settle down in the suburbs and have the 2.5 kids and have the white picket fence and have that sort of settled down life. I will tell you as a side note, I had great fun taking the sort of spinster fear of never marrying and settling down and putting that on the white frat boy. But so Leo feels that if he is to ever have those things, to ever have that bucolic suburban life, he needs to get started. So he feels that he and Nora should have a wedding date by now. They're engaged but have no wedding date, and that they need to get moving. And then third, we have Stephen, who is Leo's older brother and Nora's best friend. And Stephen has been dithering in grad school for his umpteenth year, and he feels appalled by his own lack of progress. He feels he should have more to show for himself. And he sort of feels like there's a game of musical chairs suddenly going on where everyone else is rushing to find their seats, and he fears he's the last man standing. I think that this feeling of how do you grapple with your actual self against the backdrop of what you should be feeling is the crux of adulthood. I've had a few author events where I talked about this you know, as a thing that's particular to being in your 20s. And in one of my audiences, there was a woman who raised her hand and she said, "Honey, I'm 78 years old and I still feel that way." So I don't think it's, you know, it's maybe most acute in our 20s, but I think we grapple with it through our whole lives, the reality of ourselves versus what we would like for ourselves or what we would hope for ourselves. And what has surprised me most as this novel has come out is the assumption of love. So when people talk to me, they assume I am a Joyce fan. I have come to be one. And in the writing of this novel, of course, you know, because it sort of threw me together with Joyce in what I like to call an arranged marriage, I have grown over time to love Ulysses, but at first I didn't. I think what this reminds me of is that if you were to ever, for example, interview the oyster about the pearl, the oyster would not tell you that it had always dreamed of making a pearl. It would not tell you that when it was a baby oyster, it really wanted to make a pearl. What it would tell you is that one day it felt vexed and it felt irritated and it felt the little seed of something bothering it. And so it shaped itself around that feeling and responded to that feeling. And one day, much to its surprise, out popped an oyster. And that is how I feel about this novel, that I didn't set out to write a novel about Ulysses when I first started writing it. I didn't set out to write a novel with a capital N or create something of beauty. Instead, what happened was that I had this irritated feeling about Joyce that I let sit, and I responded to it and kept listening to it. I think we live at a time when that sense of should with a capital S is quite loud, and that little grain of sand, that little voice, can be very hard to hear. And I think that's true for a lot of reasons. You know, every day right now, media content is saturated with all the things that we should be doing, right? There are all these lists of, you know, 5 foods you should eat and 5 exercises you should do, and here's how to get better sleep, and here's how to be a better parent, and here's how to be a better this and that. We also live at a time when we compare ourselves more than ever to others around us through social media. And Louis C.K., who's a comedian whom I love, I like to say that he's sort of like Nietzsche doing stand-up. He has this great bit that he did on Conan where he talks about cell phones and the people that we've become because of cell phones and smartphones in particular, and the fact that the minute we are alone, what do? We start doing that. And if we're in the pharmacy waiting for a prescription or at a restaurant waiting for our takeout order, or even people in their cars, right, risking life and limb, my God, the last place you should be on your phone, but people do it. Why? Because that feeling of being alone, that feeling of being self-conscious, that feeling of being uncomfortable, that feeling that the sand produces, that we dislike that. And so we try and get rid of it by doing this. And my hope, you know, when I wrote the 16th of June, I didn't have an agenda. I wrote it because I just wanted to find out what would happen to these 3 characters. In hindsight, I realize all 3 of my characters are really struggling to hear that voice and to figure out what they should do as they realize their lives are not what they thought they would be or what they hoped they would be, and instead they're left with the reality of who they are. My hope in hindsight is that by listening to these characters, that we can perhaps learn how to take that voice that whispers to us so softly and bring that voice from the dark into the light. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I think everyone knows how this works. If you have a question, please raise your hand and we will get a mic right over to you. Who would like to go first?
Why did John Quinn take an interest in Joyce?
Well, part of it is Quinn's Irish background. He was long interested in promoting Irish writers. Recently, Vanity Fair reprinted one of John Quinn's articles about James Joyce, in which he's praising Joyce, and it's really the first, one of the first items of praise for A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. And I feel as if, for Quinn, helping out a novelist like Joyce was a way to connect with his own family and his own roots. And he didn't have children. It was a way to give back to this larger sense of Irishness without having children, a way to have a legacy that was rooted in Irishness and that could support people who needed supporting. And John Quinn was irascible, but he recognized talent. In a way, he's a little bit like Ezra Pound, both irascible, both good judges of talent, and people who are willing to fight for that. And so that's, you know, one schematic way of thinking about it. It's a way to get in touch with Irishness.
All right, I'm going to throw an easy one over to you then, since we're in this fair city. How did both of you celebrate Bloomsday?
Do you want to?
Sure. Yeah. Was very fortunate. I had an author event at the Strand Bookstore in New York City, and hilariously, or maybe perversely, this was my first Bloomsday event ever. It was after the publication of this novel. I had never attended a Bloomsday event before, though certainly I have visited the wonderful Rosenbach Museum here in Philly. But I was in conversation with the author David Gilbert, and the Strand threw a party for the 16th of June, and we also had a Bloomsday celebration, all while the U.S. was bringing it home on the soccer field.
Just briefly, I had a few radio interviews in the morning, mostly with the BBC. The BBC is all over Bloomsday. They're really, really big. It's basically the BBC and Philadelphia. Those are the two main main Bloomsday centers. By the early afternoon, I was done with those, and I decided to go downtown. I was in New York to the Ulysses Pub for Bloomsday. I highly recommend it to anyone who happens to be in New York for Bloomsday. I thought of going up to Symphony Space, but this year Symphony Space was doing Dubliners because it's the centenary of the 100th year anniversary of Dubliners. But in the Ulysses Pub, I was talking to Derek earlier about the way Bloomsday is celebrated in Philadelphia, and it's out in the street, and it's free, and it's engaging with the people, and that's wonderful, and it's exactly what Joyce would have wanted. And at the Ulysses Pub downtown, that's also the way they do it, but on a much smaller scale. I think there are about 100, 150 people there, and people can get up and they can read from their favorite passages of Ulysses, and there are some wonderful professional readers there. And the woman who did the Molly Bloom, the final soliloquy, was really just wonderful. And I've heard multiple versions of it before, but it was just fantastic to be there. And by about 5 or 6 o'clock, I thought, you know what? This is the perfect ending to it. I'm not going to bother with Symphony Space. I want to end it here. And I was exhausted, so I
pretty excited to be here, primarily because I read, Kevin, your Irish Times piece, the review. Mm-hmm. And it was funny, as we're talking about life being cluttered and technology and everything like that, I came across it by accident, and it was, you know, while the world was at war, Joyce, was his, you know, his own war or whatever, I'm paraphrasing clearly, but so, and then it was like, this guy's going to be around the corner, you know, so yourself, I mean, but so excited, clearly, sorry. The question being one that I didn't think I would ask, but
it's good. Be spontaneous.
You know, I heard a little bit about that recently. Yeah, you know, books and whatnot. Big one, big like a phone book. It's a legal question for you, so maybe you can snag it or maybe not. But when you were just in your talk there, you were talking about Woolsey reading the whole book.
Yes.
Which seems like, duh, you know. But would you know that if whether or not that's changed? I mean, obviously that was groundbreaking and landmark and everything. Like nowadays, if something comes in front of somebody, please tell me that they have to assess the work as a whole and not just...
Yes. Now the standard is the work as a whole. That was not the standard in 1933. The golden age of obscenity, literary obscenity, as I like to refer to it, starts really in the teens and reaches a turning point in 1933 with the Woolsey decision. And then the Supreme Court weighs in 1957 with Roth versus the United States. And that's the first time the Supreme Court defined obscenity in a certain way. And then the standard for referring to the dominant effect of a whole book wasn't officially articulated by the courts until then, until 57. So Woolsey was actually ahead of the curve, and he didn't have to do that, and he didn't insist upon changing the standards at that point. But it was bizarre. It was a bizarre thing to do. And if, when you look at the seized copy, basically the trial began because Random House, who wanted to legalize Ulysses, imported one copy of the book from Paris into the United States, informed customs officials that it was going to, that it was coming, and wanted them to seize it. When they eventually seized it, they could then start a federal case about obscenity. When you look, that specific seized copy is still at Columbia. You can go and see it at the Butler Library. You'll find along the margins little X's all along the sides of every little spot where they thought it was illegal or potentially obscene. What's surprising about it is that the DA's office also seems to have read the whole book. You'll find little X's in spots where people normally would not be looking for obscenity. Normally it's basically three chapters. It's Nausicaa, Circe, and Penelope. Those are the big contenders for it. But in Sirens you find a couple of X's. In Scylla and Charybdis you find a couple of X's. So it was surprising. Everyone took it very seriously, much more seriously than they had to.
We have time for one last question. There's a woman on the aisle right here.
If part of Ulysses, the writing of it, was for financial gain, I mean, why did Joyce chance it with the obscenities? I mean, people like Eliot were doing the same thing he was, or trying to, but the obscenities weren't there.
I'm not sure if he was looking for financial gain too much. I think he wanted, you know, the saying goes, instead of, I don't want a million readers to read my book one time. I want one reader to read my book a million times. And that's effectively what he wanted. He knew he wasn't going to get a large audience. Part of the reason why he was able to make ends meet is because of Harriet Shaw Weaver. He had a patron. Wouldn't it be great to have a patron? So he knew he wasn't going to make a lot of money with it. But the larger question is, why was he making the book progressively more obscene? It was banned in the Nausicaa episode was banned in 1921. When Joyce got news of the guilty conviction, instead of making it nicer and more family-friendly, he made it worse. Why would you do that? There is, I think, a perverse, this is a little bit speculative, and so I don't talk about it too much in the book, but there was a perverse, I think, desire to transgress and to keep transgressing further and further and to push the envelope as much as possible in order to be banned. And I think there was a deep desire to be banned in the way that Joyce entertained a desire to be betrayed. And it was a strange way of, I think, of dealing with loneliness. You know, and Maya, you mentioned earlier about the sort of difficulty of Ulysses and the sort of coldness that that it has. And I think that's definitely true, and the sort of slow sense of, as you were saying, that, you know, you hated it first, and then as time goes on, it sort of works upon you slowly. And I think that's there's that aspect of the book that does that, where Joyce wanted to write a book that would force you to lean in more closely. And I think the reason why Ulysses was difficult is because Joyce was lonely. And I think this was a way to engage with a small number of readers on a very intimate level. And that's the sort of thing he wanted. It was difficulty was a response to loneliness. So, yeah.
I think he also, there's an element of sort of playing the Mr. Darcy to the Elizabeth Bennet. rather than being, you know, charming and warm and fuzzy and endearing at first, that there is that chilly quality. What does it do? It makes you lean in, yeah. As you said. It makes you, it's like the arranged marriage. You're not swept up at first. Over time, you get past that chill and you start to see, you know, you start to find love. You start to find the passages that speak to you despite that chilliness. And soon you don't see the chilliness. You see the beauty. You see the luminous prose. You see those passages that take up residence in your brain.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join us upstairs for the book signing. Let's thank our authors.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.